This sounds like a good story.
Good morning, colleagues and public. I'm opening this Monday, March 4th, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Today we're going to be covering two broad topics, topics which are distinct and yet in many ways interrelated. The first we'll be hearing about workforce development writ large in the state, continuing our Higher Ed 101, this time with the report from the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. And then we will be hearing about career technical education and efforts to revitalize career technical education in this state. It should be very, very interesting. So with that, I'm going to open an informational hearing on the OWIB, Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and it is my pleasure to bring up Rosie Pryor, who's the chair of that board, Agnes Balassa, who's the governor's workforce policy advisor, and Cam Preuss, who is director of CCWD, Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Rosie, thanks for coming up here for us.
Good morning. So you're ready for us? Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, I am so tickled to be here this morning. I've come from Eugene to meet with you and share with you some of what we're working on. I am the chair of Oregon's Workforce Investment Board, and my day job is to be an administrator with Oregon's second largest state chartered credit union, Oregon Community Credit Union, based out of Lane County. And I even volunteer as a member of the Lane Community College Board of Education. So I'm very, very focused on and invested in workforce and employment and training activities. So I would like to just share with you some of who the Workforce Investment Board is and the work that we've been doing.
Okay, so, Rosie, before you begin, could you state your name for the record?
Thank you. Yes. Rosie Pryor. And do you want my address?
No, that's
okay.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Guide me along. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. So what is the OWIB? We are an independent, private sector-led board that advises the governor on workforce policy. The OWIB's membership includes a private sector majority appointed by the governor, along with elected officials, labor, education, and local community service providers, and state agency heads and managers who administer workforce programs. And I'd like to take a minute to acknowledge and thank both Representative Denbrough and Representative Huffman for their service on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Thank you both for your help and your guidance. The board develops a strategic workforce plan that sets the vision and provides the strategies for aligning the state's workforce programs to meet common goals. Oregon also has seven local workforce investment boards whose job it is to lead the implementation of the strategic plan at the local level. I'm an example of someone who has served on my local Lane County workforce board for close to 9 years now. So having the opportunity to participate at the state level has been a true opportunity for me to capitalize on that education at the local level. These local workforce investment boards are the state board's implementation team. In December 2011, the governor gave us an urgent call to action to enhance innovation, improve collaboration, and increase accountability across the workforce system in light of a changing economy. The governor asked the OWIB to develop a strategic plan to address these challenges while finding efficiencies and improving outcomes for Oregonians. We responded to the challenge with a new strategic plan, Oregon at Work. This is my favorite slide. There's our plan, right there. Everything you need to know about our plan. I mean, I like to be succinct. There it is. The vision is quality jobs and skilled workers, a strong state economy, and local prosperity. We have a goal for workers. We have a goal for employers. And we have a goal for alignment and efficiency. And all of this is supported by three fundamental strategies: sector strategies, work-ready communities, and system innovation. So let me dig in just a little bit on what our strategies are. Our first strategy to achieve this vision is about sector strategies. And these are employer-driven partnerships to meet the needs of key industries within a regional market. This is aligning workforce activity in Oregon to support economic development activity right at the local level. Partners include business, labor, economic development, education, training providers, and other stakeholders. Sector partnerships remove bottlenecks that inhibit recruitment, hiring, training, and worker advancement within a specific industry. They create formal career paths to good jobs, reducing barriers to employment, and sustaining or increasing middle-class jobs. Sector strategies are a national best practice for workforce development. Local boards have identified key industry sectors based on labor market data and are convening or expanding partnerships to meet the workforce needs of these sectors. These sector strategies are being used by states across the country, and the results are impressive. Our second strategy in our strategic plan is about certified work-ready communities. These are communities certified by a third party as having a skilled and talented workforce. We're using the National Career Readiness Certificate, which you voted into law several sessions ago, as the basis for our efforts. Certification as a work-ready community indicates that a community is taking steps to ensure its citizens have the talent necessary to staff existing jobs, master new technologies, and embrace innovation. Certification signifies that a community wants to transform its economic base and gain a competitive edge in attracting new business and jobs. Our third strategy in our plan is about system innovation and alignment for success. This is about the workforce system at both the state and local level working together to achieve common outcomes. System innovation will require the workforce system to review and evaluate current programs and processes in light of how these support the greater system goals and add value to the experiences of customers, businesses and job seekers, and the services provided to them. Achieving this requires an aligned and transparent workforce budget that commits resources to regional interests throughout a local unified plan, which is based on our strategic plan. And the plan uses the model of achievement compacts to build local compacts for the workforce system. So what about outcomes? For the first time, we are using system data to measure system-wide performance goals, to set and measure system-wide performance goals, and to track outcomes toward these goals. We're very excited about this plan. While the work to accomplish our goals will be difficult, we are committed to transforming our workforce system in a way that brings transparency, alignment, and coordination. I just returned from a conference of other board chairs across the nation and the country, and the energy around workforce transformation was incredible. Oregon is already a leader in integration of services, and I know that if we work this plan, we can make Oregon an even better place for business and for workers to thrive.
Thank you. Thank you, Rosie.
Yeah.
Any quick questions anything that Rosie said? Yes, Representative.
Thank you for your service and all your hours you're putting into this. Back to the map. I don't understand. We have seven local workforce investment boards, but is all the green one?
Explain that.
Yes.
Is it not true that the green is probably where we need more workforce development than anywhere else in the state?
Chair Dembro, Representative Wisnett. Yes, all.
Kim. Could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to jump in and answer the question. For the record,
you had coffee this morning.
For the record, Cam Preust, Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Chair Dembro, Representative Wisnett. It's a 24-county service delivery area. They have nine different providers. So it's the nine providers.
The dark black areas.
Well, yes, actually, exactly so. The heavier boundary lines do represent the districts of those nine providers. And so they're the ones who are the boots on the ground connected to the local economy and community.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Please.
Just a comment. Well, and I, again, this is your leadership is volunteer. I appreciate it all the time. And But I hope that we're looking at outcomes and what we're doing in those, you know. I live in Central Oregon. We got, the actual unemployment is 20%. Crook County, I think, officials 12. Jefferson 11. Deschutes 10. We're really hurting in those areas. We need your help. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Just one quick question. I noticed when the slide originally came up that there was a name for down here pointing at Josephine and Jackson County, and then it went away. Is there a reason for that, or
it's a big slide?
It's trying to escape.
Yeah.
Let's see. All right. I just wondered if maybe it had been, taken out of the system or what it was. But
late breaking news.
Yes. Look, there's nothing. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you. You mentioned in your report a little bit about achievement compacts and how they're driving the process. Could you elaborate a little bit on that, please?
Yeah, actually, that's probably something Agnes can address when she does her report. And I'll turn it over to Agnes now. But before I do, though, just a sort of preface to that, one of the things Agnes is going to be talking about is House Bill 4141. And, in front of you is the executive summary of that, of the report that was called for in that, as well as the full report. House Bill 4141 was a bill that we passed in the February session, and the goal of it was to encourage the kind of alignment work that the OIB was doing, and also to call for a higher level focus on getting a clear sense of all the funding streams that are coming into workforce development, many of them federal, but delivered in all sorts of ways, and so that we can have a global sense of them, how much is actually going into workforce development, and then the outcome side. So what are we getting for all of this investment? This report, this 4141 report, is a first stab at moving in that direction, and Agnes will tell us more about it and about further work that needs to be done.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Agnes Galasso, the Governor's Workforce Policy Advisor, and I want to thank you for the opportunity for all of us to be here today. Any one of us could probably give various components of this piece, and so with your indulgence, we may move back and forth as we answer questions amongst us, trying to make sure that we have all of your interests met. I'm going to start. Representative Denbrough has already framed up the bill around House Bill 4141 in the report. So I'm going to start with what I was asked to do when I first came on board and how that dovetails with the work that the legislature was also requesting. When I came on as the governor's workforce policy advisor, essentially my charge was that we're in a changing economy. We're in an economy where, for the first time in decades, rebound has not necessarily produced significant job growth, and that we need to try to look at new solutions to address that. That we have a workforce system that consists of many moving parts, a complicated system that needs some alignment and some clarification, especially as resources are shrinking. And as you're all probably very aware, with the sequestration that went into place on Friday, those resources are even more precious now than they were before. We are going to be seeing cuts in the system. We're already understanding what those cuts will make in our unemployment departments, unemployment insurance programs. We're in process of discovering exactly what that means for the rest of the programs that we describe as WorkSource. So part of the construct then was no new money. That's even clearer today than it was then. And this idea that we need a dynamic and effective workforce system that uses all of its resources to help people really reflected the fact that a lot of these programs are federally managed, federally designed, and therefore have sometimes conflicting federal policies and rules that make it hard to organize these for citizens and businesses at the local level. Rosie's described the Oregon Workforce Investment Board's plan, which is an attempt to create some leadership and guidance about how to align those resources for better services. House Bill 4141 had a lot of the same themes in it. Highly skilled, high-wage workforce, resources alignment for job creation, industry competitiveness, skill development. I've highlighted all the words that really resonated with the task that we have all been assigned to figure out between the OIB, the agencies in workforce development, and our office, and the the requests within House Bill 4141. Excuse me. Apologies. From a workforce perspective, I think one of the challenges in understanding this system is that it overlaps with so many other systems. Workforce development, you have education, which has workforce development as a core central piece of its mission. You have a set of workforce development programs whose mission is primarily to get people into work, to get people into better work, to raise wages, to retain people in jobs, to move them along a continuum, which overlaps with the education mission as well. You also have overlap with economic development. And so as we started to talk about the... thank you so much.
Thanks.
As we started to talk about the OWIB strategic plan, we used this diagram frequently to talk about the overlaps and what would be under OWIB's guidance, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board's guidance, versus what is under the OEIB's guidance and other entities' guidance, trying to figure out where we could make the biggest impact on this set of programs. And so I think that's one of the things we would like to come back and talk with you more about as we figure out exactly how to create alignment within this system, alignment with the education system, and possibly more integration alignment with the education pieces and economic development pieces. This is my easiest way of trying to describe what this means. And I struggled with this on Friday, to be honest, because we have many, many drawings and many, many pictures, but none of them fully capture everything that we'd like to be able to show you. Essentially, the programs that we said that were within the circle for the purposes of workforce, so within that workforce circle, we talked about the programs on the left-hand side of this page. These were programs where workforce was a primary component of the mission of the program. The agency's mission may or may not have been workforce as a primary piece, but the programs themselves had workforce clearly identified as part of their mission. The ones on the right-hand side also have workforce as part of their mission, in some cases more clearly than others, and they're kind of in that overlap area. They're the ones that you could easily say they fall on one side or the other, depending on your viewpoint and perspective. And so that's what we were trying to sort out. And over the next several months, we may decide that this list isn't exactly the way we want it to look, but this was at least a starting point for a sort and a way to get our heads around what fits where. The way the services are delivered at the local area is through more than 40 WorkSource Oregon centers. These centers are primarily built on employment department sites, but in other cases may be in community centers and other places, depending on what resource you have in terms of infrastructure on the ground. And the idea is that they integrate multiple programs and services. This system served, just a couple years ago, over 280,000 Oregonians. So it's big in terms of the number of people who touch it. Most of these people are unemployed or underemployed, and you don't hear a lot about this system except in terms of the UI components of it, the unemployment insurance components of it. But the system was designed with a consistent model to assure that every Oregonian gets some level of consistent services regardless of where they are. And so we have a welcome problem that process that ends with recommendations into next steps. Those next steps are what we call our skill development service, which is about job getting, things like resume writing, polishing up your interview skills, all of those kinds of things. Talent development, which are more shorter-term interventions, and then referrals for training and on-the-job training programs. And then you have your business services, which ultimately your businesses are saying what they need. These skilled workers move into those businesses. The feedback from businesses helps us continually improve the services. So that's the design that we're trying to reach, even with all of those funding streams and silos that you saw in the other picture. We have multiple pictures trying to show program flow, governance flow, all of those things. And so we pulled this one out of the plan because it was our way of trying to describe how we're trying to align all of these. I have to admit, I struggled with finding just one picture. And we talked about this when we were developing the plan. We almost would have needed a 3D printer to design the kind of picture to explain how all these moving parts interact. But essentially, what you have here is that you have the resources come to the state with some guidance from the governor. They go to state agencies. The OWIB has an input as to how those resources are aligned and directed for services through a compact that we're in the process of developing. those resources then go to the local level, some of them directly through the local boards, some of them through state agencies, some of them through a variety of other contracts that state agencies have at the local level. And that's part of what we're getting our heads around. That's part of what we're trying to sort out as Representative Dembrow in his bill specifically asked for greater transparency. That's part of how we're trying to sort all of these pieces. The compacts are going to look different than education compacts. They will have some similar aspects. They will have outcomes. They will have clarification of roles and responsibilities, because in our system, it's not clear who does what unless you put that down on paper, because you have so many different components and pieces. So with an education system where you can say school district does X, Y, and Z, and you have a clear line of authority, in ours we need to clarify some of those roles and responsibilities. And then they will have the local strategic plans as an attachment about how they will carry out this work in the local communities. We're in the process of negotiating those and just starting on that. In terms of the report, these were some of the things that came out as recommendations about how we actually implement the plan. Because what we looked at was the OWIP had created the North Star, right? They had created the guidance about where we're headed and about what we want to achieve. So the question as we filled out, as we went through the process of looking at the requests of House Bill 4141 was, how do we then get there? What more infrastructure and supports do we need to put in place? And so clarifying the roles and expectations of the local and state boards is a critical piece. Talking to board members at the state and local level, the question was just how far does our authority reach? Exactly what is it that we're responsible for beyond just plan design? What is our role in implementation on all this? And so that's one of the things we need to clarify. Aligning state administrative functions between all of these programs, as the money goes down, it becomes harder and harder to maintain some of the systems and services. And the question is, how do we do that together to gain greater efficiencies, as opposed to each program trying to figure it out alone? Focus on WorkSource Oregon. We want to build out what's in this middle box. In here, as you look at the talent development pieces, in our economy, as it's constantly changing, what we're looking at is what more can we do there? We don't have the resources to only refer people to training. What more can we do to build out the options, things like increasing the National's Career Readiness Certificate, things like other kinds of certifications that may help people quickly return to work as our economy continues to grow?
And I know some of that might involve partnerships with private
industry. Absolutely. Implementing the OWIP plan still requires a detailed work plan. We're in the process of building that right now. And then increasing the coordination among institutions of higher education, community colleges, labor, and apprenticeships. Our OWIP committee did not address this one because we weren't sure that we had the right team at the table to do that. That was part of the bill in House Bill 4141, and we support continued work on that and would like to know exactly how we should engage in that work. And then budgeting for workforce innovation, which is a segue into what Cam's going to be talking about.
Great. Thank you, Agnes. Any quick questions for Agnes?
Make a quick comment.
Yes.
Colleagues, something several years ago that I had not connected the dots as far as, you know, who was involved in my region, who was involved in WorkSource, who were the OWIBs, who were the members, and how did they relate to each other. And my guess is that if you were asked up here, you know, who does this and who does this and who does this, you may not be able to put a finger on the name, but if we told you who that person was in your district, you would go, oh yeah, I know them and I know the work they're doing. And so you'd be able to start connecting the dots. In the Gorge, Mid-Columbia, you know, since this has evolved, Reb Johnson and I have done an extensive amount of work to try to make sure that all the members are communicating with each other, from Frank Toda at Columbia Gorge Community College to John Arns with WorkSource to Ron Freeman at the Employment Department to the school districts in Hood River and the Dalles and Duffer and Sherman County and all of them, to make sure that they're all communicating and working as one workforce region. And then implementing ideas that we've come up with over the years as unemployment started growing, looking at the employment department and saying, instead of somebody just coming in and signing up for an unemployment check, how can we work them into the workforce system if they need skilling up to get them from a $10 an hour job to a $13 an hour job? And that's done through the employment department into WorkSource, into maybe community colleges or training centers. So I encourage you to go back into your district and start finding out, and Agnes can supply who those names are in your district so you can start plugging into what they're doing.
Thank you for that, Greg Puffman. Okay, Cam, so show us where the money's going.
For the record, Cam Preuss from CCWD. There is, in the governor's budget, a recommendation for a $10 million investment. Agnes, would you push the button? It's been a long time since there's been a general fund investment in workforce development, and Agnes made mention of the sequestration, but if we were to show you a graph of the last 5 years of federal funding for workforce programs, you probably wouldn't be surprised to see that the trend line is down, not up. And part of that is because there are other states that actually have a worse economy than Oregon, so our share of the federal resource is also dwindling. But we've lost more than $20 million in the last 5 years. This resource comes at a very needed time, not just because the federal budget is impacted, but because where Agnes started, our economy is changing, and we need new tools in our toolbox in order to prepare workers for the jobs that are being created, or those jobs that individuals are either through attrition or whatever. So we're wanting to scale up some efforts, some existing efforts. The governor in his 2011 budget put $3.28 million in a program called Back to Work Oregon, and so we're going to advance that by putting a little more money in. You can see on the slide, so I don't have to read this to you, but Representative Huffman and Representative Dembro in 2009 did pass legislation to, as Rosie indicated a little earlier, to put the National Career Readiness Certificate in state law, and did task the department with moving it, expanding it statewide. And we have done that. We have done it with primarily federal, little bit of flexible federal money that we have. You can see there that the Back to Work Oregon is an on-the-job training where an individual applies for a job and they may have 75% of the skills that are required. They might have 80%. And we sit down with that employer and talk about what skills are still lacking and write a training plan. The employer then has some of the wages of that individual reimbursed while they are in training. It's a very successful program. And you can see there that almost 1,400 Oregonians participated in the program, and their average wage was better than $14 an hour, and it was a great return on investment for payroll, taxes in that program. And we're wanting to expand it, almost double it, in the governor's budget. The next investment is including the National Career Readiness Certificate and advancing to certified work-ready communities. You notice that this is also part of the OWIB strategic plan, the certified work-ready communities. And you can see that that investment, that 1.6, has been primarily federal workforce dollars, but we do have what we think we're reaching critical mass of employers who have signed on to prefer an individual who has a National Career Readiness Certificate when they hire, and we have over 21,000 individuals who have that certificate. You can see there is some statistics that employers are more likely to hire, and individuals are more likely to have higher wages with the National Career Readiness Certificate. Our plan is to have 100,000, so we're at 20,000, or a little over 20,000. So we have great work to do, and this resource is critical to make that happen.
Kim, can I jump in for a moment with a couple of things? When we passed that legislation on the National Career Readiness Certificate, we did also ask the departments to look at ways of incentivizing the incorporation of NCRC into the community colleges and into K-12. Has that been happening? Are there any school districts or colleges that are incorporating that certificate, you know, as a sort of evaluative standard for students?
Chair Dembo, yes, but I would say probably not to the extent that either of us would like. There is a basic manufacturing certificate that 8 of the community colleges deliver, and the NCRC is a critical component in that certificate. There are also the NCRC in applied math and reading are essential. They are equivalencies, if you will, in the new high school diploma, as both the math and the reading essential skills. So there are two, those are at least two examples. We do have a number of school districts that are interested in the NCRC. We are really taxed, if you will, to find the resources to do that. Because of the resources that we use, they are primarily must be for adults, so that we don't get into hot water with our federal partners. But as I said, we are in conversation with school districts that would like to use it, and trying to expand to them.
Thank you. Yeah, I remain committed to the idea that if students are graduating with that additional credential,
yes,
that's going to help them down the road.
Absolutely. We concur, Chair Dembo.
Thank you. Yeah, and could you also say a little more about the certified work-ready communities? This is something that, this is not just an Oregon thing. This is something we're seeing in other states as well. Is that right?
Yes, Chair Dembo. Oregon is actually one of four states that has been, I guess we applied to be a pilot with these three other states and to really develop the concept of what does it mean to have a certified work-ready community. And Agnes probably has better detail, or there are people behind me who have better detail on exactly, but it's looking at the to be a certified work-ready community, as Rosie said, it's third-party certification. So a community would actually apply, and we're looking at their rate of diplomas, high school diplomas, and other certificates and degrees that the community has as a way of, if you will, by zip code, being able to talk to businesses about the talent pool that exists in that community.
Chair Dembro, if I may, I think what's exciting about the work-ready communities is that there's an economic development component to it, which is what Cam has just indicated, that economic developers, businesses can say, this is what our talent pool looks like in a very concrete way, just in terms of the foundational problem-solving skills. I think the other piece that's exciting about it, though, is actually bringing in more of the community members. It gets back to the vision that was originally the impetus behind creating the National Career bringing the National Career Readiness Certificate into Oregon, which is that it wasn't just that WorkSource centers would be issuing these. It was that whole communities would be engaged. And as Cam was saying, what we're finding is school districts are now coming to the table in a different way, saying, you know, we're a small school district. We want a competitive edge. Can this help us? You're starting to have folks in a variety of areas saying, what does this mean for my business? How does my business participate? And so it's creating new conversations. So it's not just about certificates and not just about testing. It's about conversations, mm-hmm. about skill development in a way we haven't been able to have before, as people are starting to understand what it means to have foundational skills and how critical those are. We now have profiles of over 17,000 businesses that show that these are the concrete core skills that are absolutely necessary for all 17,000 of those job titles. So you can actually have a conversation about the skills match between what does the job require and what does the certificate show, as opposed to just some assumption that a business makes that I need somebody with a certain level of education. This can actually start to tie it together in a much more concrete way.
And when you talk about foundational skills, so these are skills that a worker can take from job to job.
Absolutely.
Right, they may be laid off, at, you know, a company they're working for goes under, but they can then take those same skills and transfer them.
Absolutely.
Quick one.
Yes, Rep. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As follow-up to some of the conversations we've heard from representatives from the more rural portions of the state, what's the distribution of these work-ready communities around the state?
They will be throughout the state. What we've asked is for the local areas to apply as they're based on their readiness. But in order to reach this goal, we will need to reach goals in every part of the state.
And are there applications coming in? Are there...
Yes, every part of the
towns
state.
Towns and cities in process.
It's at the county level that the applications roll up mm-hmm. and through the local boards. And what we have a plan right now where every county will be participating within 3 years. Doesn't mean they'll all be certified within mm-hmm. 3 years, but in some counties, the numbers won't be huge. So they'll be easier to meet than in other places.
Thanks.
Rep. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Blas, our commissioner, on the slide you talk about $95 each for the NCRC. Is that what we're paying? Is that how, what is the $94? And I think both of you know I'm a big supporter of this. I learned about this about 8 years ago. Georgia's led the effort. It was presented at an ALEC convention about the NCRC program. They have them with license plates and billboards and,
oh, really?
And everything. So.
So
I'm worried about the. I'm looking at the money, and so if you can talk about the $95, and how much are we getting from the federal government? How much is in the governor's budget? And because the way I understand sequestering is we're not getting cut, we're just not getting as much increase as we thought we were. So, so if you can comment on that, please.
Yes.
Yeah.
Chair Dembo, Representative Wisnett. The $94, let's start there. When we built our plan to roll out the NCRC, we budgeted about $100 per certificate because neither the business nor the individual pay. The state supports the preparation for the assessment as well as the cost of the actual test, if you will. Also, the state is it's reimbursing our local boards and others who are our delivery system for this to call on businesses and get businesses to sign up to prefer the NCRC in hiring. So that's, and we expect that number to go down. Mm-hmm. When we first started, we weren't really sure what it was going to cost us. So that's how we budgeted for it. To sequestration, we actually expect one of our favorite words in federal workforce is a rescission, which means the money they gave us in October, they're going to reduce it. We're a forward-funded program, the Workforce Investment Act, and so we will see, we think, approximately 5% rescission to our resources yet this year.
How much is in the GUPS, Mr. Chair?
How much I'm glad you remembered all three questions.
I don't get much chance on this.
There's about $2.8 million in the $10 million that will go to support the NCRC.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative. Rep. Quinlan.
Yes. I'm interested in this table because one might assume that it was taking the exam that made somebody 28% more likely to be employed. I wonder whether you looked at what differentiated those, the people who signed up to the NCRC versus those that didn't, both to see what the differences in the individuals are, but also to see how to overcome some barriers to get other people aligned with the NCRC.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Greenlich, I may need to follow up with you, if I might, to truly answer your question. We are collecting demographic information and wage information on the individuals, but I don't have it crisply in at the tip of my tongue to answer the question. There is some difference. We do find that NCRC holders tend to have a high school diploma or higher, but beyond that, I think the demographics are pretty even, but I want a chance to follow up with real data, if I might.
Please.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling would be these are people who are likely to be more ambitious, more aggressive, more comfortable with doing testing and a variety of things like that. So, some of it might be inherent to business, and some of it is the fact that they have a credential that's a very important credential.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Dembrough?
Yes.
Representative Greenlich, just a response to that from the perspective of an employer who prefers NCRC prepared candidates for openings in our credit union. We have a fair amount of churn in relatively entry-level positions in the credit union industry, and finding individuals who are NCRC certified means we don't have to take the time to ascertain that they have the foundational skills required to work in financial services where accuracy is paramount. We can set that aside and focus on fit, which saves us a lot of time, a lot of money in our recruitment and hiring process. So there are some real advantages to the employer. So that's the sort of the incremental approach we have to take. There's always in any new program going to be a low-hanging fruit phenomenon, and I think your allusion to people who might be more inclined to take the tests, you know, in the early stages of a program like this makes sense to me. But at the end of the day, I think there's the opportunity to illustrate, especially if we can get this more broadly adopted by Oregon's community colleges and school districts, to help people entering the workforce and who are currently in the workforce to understand how helpful this credential could be in expediting the hiring process.
Thank you. Kim, did you have more?
Yes, we have one more.
Thank you.
This has already been mentioned, the sector strategies. There is a piece of the $10 million that would help convene businesses at the local level. Essentially, what we're looking for is aggregating demand by having an intentional conversation with employers about what their skill needs are, not guessing, not thinking that what we had 5 years ago is relevant. And I think this it actually ties to some of the legislation you're going to be talking about next, particularly around career and technical programs. But we want to aggregate that demand by, as I said, having conversations with local businesses. We have asked the seven local workforce investment boards to pick three places or three different sectors that they want to concentrate on. It won't surprise you that healthcare is a winner all across the state, as is manufacturing or advanced manufacturing. And then it starts to it becomes illustrative of the local economy. So in Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, there's more agriculture sector where there wouldn't be in the metro area. So essentially what we're going to do is use this as an organizing strategy to make sure that the demand for skills and the supply of skills is graded well together. So that's the last strategy.
Thank you, Kim. Yes, for Putnam.
Refresh my memory, I apologize. I got a little busy with this thing called campaigning and stuff, so I wasn't as involved in developing the plan as I should have been at that critical point. But refresh my memory if we have, or if we plan to, or if we could, if we haven't done it already, maybe in the convening of the businesses, ask businesses, in their experiences, are there state regulations or things holding them back from employing more, expanding, or whatever, so that OWIB can kind of help take the lead on trying to correct some of that stuff at the state level?
Chair Dembro, Representative Huffman, as someone who had the opportunity to implement some fledgling sector strategies once upon a time when I was working at the local level, one of the things we found very quickly, by having economic development there at the table, businesses would come up with both training issues, pipeline issues, and regulatory issues. And in our case, what we did, and this has become part of the best practice that other, as you know, this sector strategies has progressed and become more documented about how you do it. Part of the best practice is having the opportunity to have those who can answer other types of questions as well. So our economic development folks were the ones who were able to speak the language, to frame up what those issues were so that we could figure out how to organize around those kinds of conversations, in our case with the city of Salem, with the county, because we were here in this area. And so if sector strategies are done right, you have that whole complement of folks at the table, and the conversation may start with what are your training needs. It may start with what are your pipeline needs. It may start with how do you move and progress people, and how can we help make sure that people come to you with the skills to be able to move up. But inevitably, when you get a group of businesses together and talking, sooner or later, it'll go to what's wrong with government, and they'll tell us.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, all three of you, for coming before us. We have one more person to speak.
Okay.
And he's a representative from a local workforce investment board. Yes, Andrew? Andrew McGough, would you please come up?
Thank you for the opportunity.
Great.
Thank you.
And tell us from a local perspective what's wrong with this plan. Why are these people beating up on you? No.
How much time do I get?
5 minutes.
Remember?
Yeah, that's right. Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Andrew McGough. I'm the executive director of Work Systems, Inc., which is the workforce board that serves the city of Portland, Multnomah, and Washington counties. I don't have a PowerPoint this morning, but do really appreciate the opportunity to come and just give some local perspective about how we see this working, and actually kind of be the local cheerleader, if you will. One thing that really sticks out for me when I listen to the folks at the state level talk about this system is that it is very, very complicated. Locally, we manage about 48 different funding streams. Some of them originate at the state. Some of them originate at the federal level. Some of them originate locally. So it's a very sort of complicated, difficult to manage system, both practically at the administrative level, but then when you think about it programmatically, it's really tough when you're trying to serve everyone who needs some basic educational skills all the way up to a dislocated technology worker in my community. So things like WorkSource Oregon and the integration that has happened over the last few years have been remarkable changes to the system and have resulted in what I think is really a revolution in the delivery of workforce services at the local and state level. So that's another point I would just want to make here, is that the level of alignment is extraordinary today. I've been in this system for a long time in lots of different places, but I have never seen a state-local level alignment as I'm beginning to see now. And I think, you know, given sort of the decreasing resources, and something we haven't talked about in that decreasing resource level is an increasing in demand for people who need these services. And the only way we're going to solve that is by working together both at the state and local level. And I think we're really on a great path to doing that. And so I guess I would just close by saying that we look forward at the local level, both through the business representation that sits on my board, to the local elected officials who are highly engaged in this system, to our state partners, to our community college partners. We have worked together for a long time, and I think that this new strategy, the new plan that we're beginning to see and start to implement, is a really smart step in the right direction, and look forward to being a good partner moving forward.
Thank you, Andrew.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Rep. Greenlick.
Could you put a face on this whole thing for me? I mean, could you tell me, let me give you a couple examples. I just graduated from high school and I'm trying to find a job. Or I'm 50 years old and my company just moved to Cincinnati and I'm trying to find a job. How do those people interact with all the programs we're hearing about?
In multiple ways, they interact in multiple ways. But we, you know, I think the work source structure provides an opportunity to serve people in a more effective way in sort of a mass system. Here's sort of a story. In 2007, we enrolled about 6,000 people into our local programs and services. Last year, we were well over 100,000 people. So that's the magnitude of change that we've seen in this system. And having some level of walking through a door and understanding what the front end of that system looks like, whether you're an 18-year-old or you're a 50-year-old dislocated worker, we have to do those things to better understand what the best next steps are. And I think what this system alignment has allowed us to do is ask appropriate questions in a common way, but it leads us to better individual services on the back end. So even though we're seeing all of these new people coming through the doors and an enormous variety of people coming through the door, I think that the sort of finding the appropriate mix of common services, but then with an end game of trying to customize those services as effectively as possible is starting to emerge in this system. Not perfect, but we're getting there.
So if I could just, let me just say, so what we're talking about here is sort of the philosophy of the one stop, aren't we?
Yeah.
So that, you know, whether you're straight out of high school or you're coming, you know, a returning worker, you would go to the same place and then you would be, you know, channeled into the appropriate place.
Yes.
Right?
That's the idea. And the idea is, you know, look, we've lost the capacity to individually work with people. We just don't have that. You can't go from 6,000 to 100,000 and spend significant times with people. So we have to think about systemically and through programs and activities, how do we structure those in a way that most effectively allows people to make choices and decisions that move them on a path that we know is a good next step for them.
Yes, Rick Greenman.
Perhaps I try and state the question again because I didn't hear the answer. What does it really look like as either that 18-year-old or that 50-year-old? What do they do? There is a door. They come in a door. Fortunately, I haven't had to worry about that. But what does it look like? What happens to them?
Okay, an individual would walk through a door, whether you're 18 or 50, and the first thing you do, as Agnes mentioned earlier, is a process we call welcome. And within that process, people look at, in order to apply for the system, you go online and you fill out some demographic information, some employment history, some, you know, goals that you might have moving forward. So there's a cadre of information there that allows a more formal conversation at that front end. It used to be that you would also participate in a basic skills indicator test called the individual, I can't remember what it's about, but it was essentially a front-end test that gives you some indicator of basic skills. So then that person sitting across from you in that welcome process talks to you about your work history. About your work history, about your educational experience, and about your goals moving forward. And they look at local labor market information. They look at educational opportunities to sort of begin the process of a plan. And then within that facility, there are also a variety of, like, workshops and other services that would be available. So if you are a young 18-year-old person who had very limited work experience, no resume, no interview, didn't know where you wanted to go to work, we have a career planning workshop that would be a logical next step to sign that individual up for. So he would go to that career planning workshop to help him better understand what were the options and opportunities out there. And then from there, or if you're the 50-year-old and you need to transition immediately, we might have access to, say, a group of people from a like industry, a networking opportunity where you could go in a structured way and meet with people who were in similar industries, because you're not interested in going to school, or you have bills and you need to pay them, and your interest is in getting reconnected with the labor market as quickly as possible. So it's really about customizing services to meet a variety of needs. And we have about maybe about 40 different workshops that are available in the metropolitan area. And then beyond that, we do have things like scholarships, adult internships, as well as on-the-job training opportunities. So it's a whole array of services, and the question is, we try and customize those for individual needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Greenlee. Rep. Huffman.
Okay, Andrew, I don't even know what I don't know. I don't even know that you have a door. I have a need, and I know what my need is. I'm unemployed, or I need to skill up. I need to get a better job. I don't even know about your door. How do I find out about your door, and then how do I find out where your door is? I think is maybe even more basic to Rep. Greenlee's question.
Mm-hmm. You know, in our area, as was mentioned earlier as well, all of our offices are co-located either in Oregon Employment Department offices or in, we have one site that's on a community college campus, one is in a not-for-profit organization, a community-based organization in the southeast section of the city. You know, I got to be honest, we have way more people that are coming in to our facilities than we have the capacity to deliver, you know, comprehensive services to. So it's sort of that network of college, public employment service offices, community-based organizations. Again, we probably had more than 100,000 people come through our doors last year, so someone's hearing about them. That said, I think we're constantly trying to promote those facilities through our local governments and through things like the mayor last year of the city of Portland actually did an advert on one of the utility bills to go into those facilities. So we're constantly trying to figure out how do we get people aware, and any suggestions would be most appreciated.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. A follow-up.
You made a comment that concerned me, and maybe it's because of the overwhelming numbers, but you said people used to come in and do a skills test.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was, we had put that in place over the years, and it was my understanding that everybody that came in was doing a skills test now. It had kind of lapsed, but Lori Warner told me it was back.
Yeah, it's always been available. It was essentially mandated a couple of years ago, and so it did result in everybody that came through had that test. We kind of backed a little bit because the front end was taking so much time. People were getting overwhelmed with the numbers of people and the amount of time it was taking at the front end. I think you're going to see it come back. I mean, I think it's kind of gone. It was up there, kind of went down a little bit, but it's coming back up because it's such vital information to have on the front end. You need that. And you especially need it in an NCRC environment where you're trying to move people to the accomplishment of the NCRC. So I think we're going to see it come back more robustly than it is right now. It's still there, however.
I hope so.
It's still there. Okay. Sorry.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming down here and sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, so with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and everything workforce related. This was our top-level introductory Higher Ed 101 introduction to this subject. You will hear further work on this in some of the bills that we'll be looking at, and then some hearings that we'll be scheduling, including a special hearing on the healthcare workforce. Okay, so we're now going to switch to CTE, and what I'd like to do is we have three bills that are under consideration. I'd like to open all of them simultaneously because they're really interrelated. All right, so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill, a concurrent public hearing on House Bill 2110, House Bill 2912, and House Bill 2913. And I'll call up Elizabeth Kushwa and Brian Krieg to be our first panelists. And while they're coming up, Victoria, could you tell us what these three bills are?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2110 appropriates monies to the Department of Education to be expended for purpose of awarding grants under the Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2013. House Bill 2912 requires the Department of Education, Department of Community Colleges, and Workforce Development and Bureau of Labor and Industries to develop and implement long-term goals that establish joint advisory committees related to career and technical education and report progress toward meeting goals to Interim Committee on Education no later than December 1, 2013, declares emergency effective on passage. And House Bill 2913 clarifies that committee formed by Department of Education and Bureau of Labor and Industries is established to set goals, develop grant criteria, review grant applications, and make recommendations related to awarding grants under Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program, declares emergency effective immediately.
Okay, thank you, Victoria. And before we turn it over to the panel, colleagues, these bills are all in some ways, or actually directly, follow-ups of a bill that we passed back in 2011, House Bill 3362, which was a bill that came out of a bill whose number I can't recall that Rep. Huffman and I were involved in 2009, came out of the Workforce Development Subcommittee of Business and Labor, which called for a higher degree of partnership between school districts and business and industry and community colleges in order to turn the ship around. We've been going for years. The ship has been headed in the direction of disinvestment in career technical education in our K-12 systems, and to turn that around through creative partnerships. That bill, you may recall, 3362 in 2011, created the Revitalization Grant Program. Funded at $2 million, and I think you all signed on to it, those of you who are here. It established a record, I think, of co-sponsors, a record I suspect that will never be surpassed, but I'd love to be proven wrong in about 2 minutes. Anyway, so this all follows up on that, and let me say that bill was the result, as I said, of a process that was initiated in business and labor workforce development, but it was also the result of a lot of work that's been done over the years by our commissioner for business and labor and industries for the state, Brad Avakian, as well as just a lot of people working hard on the ground. And here before you is a representative of Boley and two of those hard-working yeomen. Okay. Elizabeth, you want to start?
Do these three bills go to Ways and Means?
That's correct.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Legislative Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I would like to start on House Bill 2110. And it has a twin in Senate Bill 498, which is a bill that almost every single legislator in the building has signed on to, and the Secretary of Senate did say it was a record. So thank you very much for your sponsorship and co-sponsorship. That bill is being heard tomorrow afternoon, and I believe Senator Hass has issued an invitation for all of you to attend. If there's any way you can get away at about 1:30 from your committees tomorrow afternoon, we have a complement of teachers, students, and business partners coming in to talk about what has been accomplished in the one short year since this grant has been in operation, and for that we thank you. Boley is pleased and thrilled to have been working with the Department of Education. It's been a very successful partnership to institute this grant program. Let me give you just a few little quick primers about CTE. In front of you, you will see a couple of things, just a top 10 quick things to know about CTE. Then you'll see a packet that has the first part of it talked about the grant recipients and the intention of those recipients for the last year, including what their business partners, business and community partners are listed under each of those, and they're anticipating matching resources that they brought to the programs. Behind that, you'll find out what they actually did with that money, and there's a little bit of a more expanded definition, explanation of each of these programs, and it's just really, truly impressive. I'll give you a quick summary. This year, CTE touched nearly 2,600 students in high school, and including about 200 in middle school in this last year in Oregon. Part of that also included investments in the programs and in technology, including restoring manufacturing engineering in Prineville. It allowed technology to be put in places in places such as Piney Eagle in Halfway, where the students' video conference with the dam run by Idaho Power in their industrial automation and control systems technology. The CTE grant program here in Oregon is a homegrown program. The programs are developed by the community for what the community needs. Building a pipeline to education or to a skilled workforce this way allows the businesses to look locally for talent and keeps brain drain from occurring. This has really happened in places like John Day, where they're building a skilled workforce of computer specialists in a viable school-to-work program in a rural setting. Little things on CTE in general. High-risk students in CTE programs are 8 to 10 times less likely to drop out of high school. The average high school graduation rate for students in CTE programs is about 90.18% compared to a national freshman graduation rate of 74.9%. But you'll know in this committee that Oregon's graduation rate is currently slightly lower than the national average. However, the CTE retention rate is higher than the national average in Oregon. So this is something that is really working here for us locally. The program is necessarily collaborative. The requirement of the community and business partners and the requirement of matching local resources ensure the buy-in that's essential for the success of the programs. You will have in front of you a sheet that has, from Canby High School, 85 business partnerships where they have job shadowing, pre-apprenticeship programs. It's quite impressive. These programs are both what you would consider traditional CTE shop classes, only advanced for the 21st century, in places like the Lynn Benton Trade Academy, as well as more STEM-related programs, for example, in Silverton High School, where they're doing Silverton and Mount Angel, where they've got sports medicine and pre-bioscience program. Interestingly enough, I think it's called WICHE, the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, indicates that high school graduates in Oregon will increase until 2024. We're going to need to figure out how to get those kids into skilled workforce positions and into higher education, or into higher education as well. I just want to leave you quickly with a quote from one of the teachers at Canby High School. She said, quote, "With these career readiness classes and the overall job shadow experience, the next natural step is the internship, and because of the CTE revitalization grant, I have been able to get out into our community and search for additional opportunities for students at Canby High School that before we only dreamed of," end quote. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Mr. Krieg.
Chair Dambrow, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. I represent the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors, the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, Sheet Metal Workers 16, and the State Association for IBEW. Pleased to be here today and to discuss something that was passed in the last main session, 2011, that being the CTE bill. That was a culmination of about a 10-year quest by many of us in the construction industry and other groups to start to turn the ship back around and get the shop classes back into our schools. And when we say shop classes, we actually mean quite a broader set of skills than that, but the career and technical types of training. To keep the kids motivated, interested in school, let them know that there are jobs out there, give them confidence so that they can move ahead and have a good life in front of them. For our industries, we need to refill the pipeline.
We have an aging workforce. We're going to need new young workers, and we need smart young workers who stayed in school, who have their math and science backgrounds in it. You can't wave a wand and make an electrician tomorrow out of a kid who didn't graduate out of high school. Apprenticeship programs have been going longer and longer in their time frame because we have to do more and more remedial work with the folks. We also have apprentices coming in at the age average out in the industry from 27 to 29 years old. That's just too late. It's too far away from their education. This is part of the remedial issues. They've also probably not had health care. They've probably not had retirement benefits being put away during that time period if they've been bouncing around. We need to get them back in the workforce. We need to increase our graduation rates. And this is the type of legislation that will get it done. Very happy to see that on Senate Bill 498, almost every member of the legislature signs it. I've never seen, in all my years working in the legislature, and that goes back to when I was an aide in the 80s in the building, a piece of legislation where there's 11 lines of sponsors, and there's only 11 lines of text to the bill, and it's a blank slate with a dollar figure that needs filled in. That's amazing. And it's amazing that we're going to move ahead and do some things with this. We know that this bill will go over to the Senate and then to the Ways and Means Committee, but getting in front of you today, we want to push and urge you to do everything you can to fund this program. This program is very closely related to STEM. You're going to hear a lot about that. It's got a little bit of buzz going on out there. But this was broader than STEM. And it's really a foundation for it. It's the place we start. And we're going to gain a lot more kids. Some of them will go on to the STEM path. And that is going to be great for the state. But this takes care of a lot of other kids out there on that. Manufacturing, construction, skilled services. This is what services it. Moving to the Bill 2913 that's in front of you. This is a smaller component of the overall measure. And what this is, it simply puts into statute how the Career and Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program Advisory Committee actually functioned. When we put this bill together, we were going out into Brave New World a little bit. We were going to have Boley round up the industry folks and get the Department of Education to round up some folks. We're going to sit down, get the rules together for the program, get the grants done. We moved very quickly. It worked very well. It was very successful. And what we want to do, we've got a couple of adjustments on here, just codify what we did, and so that the folks in the future can move ahead on that. I served on that panel. Mr. Chandler did. John Mollis is in the back of the room. Many educators from places like Coos Bay and Vail on it. It was a great group, and I have to say that the Department of Education also moved very, very quickly to get this program up in a very short amount of time and to see the success we've had. And they I have to commend them for their work on it. It was a great committee. This Bill 2913 just puts it in place, gives it the rules to move forward on.
Thank you, Brian. Brother Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. As Mr. Craig mentioned, these bills and the one over in the Senate, the one that was passed in 2011, are the end of a long march, or the beginning of a new long march, probably more accurately stated, for a lot of us in the construction site. And part of the reason I wanted to come before you this morning was the stage management of having my membership, which is predominantly non-union, and Mr. Craig's membership, and Mr. Mollis is in the back of the room, which represent the building trades unions, because this is not the usual sort of fun fist fights between labor and management or open and closed shops. This is an area where over the years we have reached a very good accord with our friends in the building trades that first we get people into the trades. Then we argue about whether or not they belong to a union. But you can't argue about whether or not they belong to a union if they don't exist in the first place. And we have done, if you don't mind me saying so, a disservice to our youngsters over the last 20, 30 years in this state by assuming that everybody ought to go to college, everybody needs to go get a four-year degree, and ignoring the trades, the crafts, the skills that you can learn in middle school and high school that can give you a very good life, a very good wage, union or non-union, doesn't matter. But we've taken a whole generation of children and said, you must be a nitwit if you don't go to college. Well, no. You may be a nitwit if you do go to college. Some should, some shouldn't. The governor set goals. These support that 40-40-20 approach by providing the infrastructure at the local level to actually have the classes open, staffed with qualified teachers, with job mentorship opportunities out in the communities. These are the best piece of legislation this body has moved in a long while, simply because they are targeted, they are aimed at a need, they're modestly priced, and they involve all the stakeholders you need to have around the table. The 2913 in particular, as Mr. Craig mentioned, we had a good process we sort of dumbed into last time. We would like to codify that process. It worked very well that way going forward. We have the infrastructure as far as the decisions and the grant reviews and all that in place as the money hopefully increases from this legislature and others, and it doesn't the process doesn't rely on the short-term memory of anybody involved in it, which is getting more and more critical. And besides, this is the sort of a program that needs to become institutionalized the way it used to be. I think having recognized the mistake that we made by defunding these programs kind of by accident, we are now very deliberately refunding them, reestablishing them, and so having that infrastructure along with that makes a lot of sense. With regard to 2110, whether this bill moves or the Senate version, it doesn't really make a lick of difference. The important thing is that it does go to ways and means. We hope when it comes out with a dollar figure in it, we can count on all of your support. We hopefully will count on your support talking to your colleagues on the Ways and Means subcommittees to make sure that number is adequate to the task. This is a critical piece of the state's business. We commend them to you and be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain. Let me just clarify, colleagues, that as far as the allocation bill for the revitalization grant program, that will move on the Senate side. That's the plan. It'll go to Ways and Means. But we wanted to have the chance to talk about it here, hence the parallel vehicle of 2110. Yes, Elizabeth.
Representative, thank you, Chair Dambro, members of the committee. I just wanted to reiterate the invitation to attend tomorrow. It's going to be heard at about 1:30, and kids are coming in from around the state, a few really amazing stories on all sides, and some business folks that, you know, people calling in from everywhere. So if you can, give it a go.
Okay. And let me add another detail. I commend Mr. Chandler for refraining from mentioning Future Farmers of America, but I will. One of the things that we learned as we were exploring this issue is how vital not only the programs that set themselves, but the sort of extracurricular student organizations that are tied to them. One of the best of them being Future Farmers, and so we have a parallel bill that. And let me say that as revenues, as resources dwindle, the first thing to go generally is those support organizations that do the extracurricular kind of wraparound work, the competitions, you know, all those things. They tend to go first, then the program follows. And so we have a bill, and it's sponsored by Representative Reardon, who himself has been involved in those kinds of programs for many years, to try to turn that ship around as well. That's going to be heard in the Education Committee sometime in the next couple of weeks, I think. And let me quickly say something about House Bill 2912, which is the one that is that's asking us to look at the industry advisory committees that the high schools have and that the community colleges have, and to see if they can't articulate better. There is some articulation going on, but there are real potentials. I think if you were to look at, say, an area like welding, you know, where in an area each school district that has a welding program is required to have its own industry advisory committee. The community college that many of those students will ultimately move to, their welding program will have its industry advisory committee. And those industry advisory committees do really great work in terms of making sure that the curriculum is relevant, that the students have a pipeline to a job, and it just seems to make sense to, you know, the more that we can get these organizations to work together, the better we'll be. So what this bill does is it directs CCWD and BOLI and the Department of Education, which now under House Bill 3362 are meeting on a quarterly basis. The revitalization grant is just one piece of what they're doing now. They're meeting quarterly to see how they can better coordinate their services. So one of their tasks will be to look at these industry advisory committees, maybe even adding somebody from the local workforce investment board to them, somebody from the economic development local board to them, look at these more in a regional sort of partnership and pipeline kind of manner. So, any questions of these witnesses? Okay, thank you both.
Mr. Chairman, please note my restraints.
Noted. But let me call up next Ian Tolleson from the Farm Bureau. John, did you want to come up? Did you want to say anything? John Mullis? That's fine.
This is exciting.
A day without Mullis is not a good day. So. And Daryl Fuller? Daryl, you want to come up?
This is personal.
In front of me.
Okay, John, do you want to just say something about your experience with this?
Yeah, good morning, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. I wasn't planning on testifying this morning, but thanks for the invitation. I would just go on record, John Mullis with the Oregon State Building Trades Council. I would just go on record as supporting the remarks made by Bushwa from Boley and Brian Krieg and John Chandler from the construction industry as well. I actually took a tour of one of the facilities that was funded this last time around in Prineville, and I was very, very impressed with the program that they have put in place. It's not a building trades related program, but it fits the needs of their community, and I was very, very impressed with the amount of support that they had, both from the school district, from local businesses, and from the teachers. Very, very well done. I don't know if they mentioned in the earlier testimony, I think there was 41 grant applications. We were able to fund, I believe, 8 of them, but those touched 21 schools. So I think we did a good job of spreading around the money as best we could, but obviously the need is great and the interest is great, and I appreciate all of your folks taking interest in these proposals. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ian Tolleson, Oregon Farm Bureau, and I would just like to thank Chair Dembrough for mentioning FFA. This is really a great partnership with the state and the local communities with the school district. According to the Department of Ag, we have the age of farmers increasing. We're now at 57. That trend looks like it will continue, and I think the FFA program is vitally important to getting students interested, not only in the broader ag community, but just to see what other opportunities out there for their education. The CTE grants are very important for that, and we would like to see that expanded, which I think the Senate bill will do, the funding request. So we definitely appreciate your support with the entire program. It's very important to us Aggies, so thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Jimbo, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller, on behalf of both the Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors Association and also the Northwest Auto Trades Association. You've already had a fairly lengthy discussion on the contractor trade, so I'll just focus my brief discussion a little bit more on the Northwest Auto Trades Association. The Career and Technical Education Program also can support auto body shops that have disappeared from most of the high schools around the state of Oregon, and those programs are incredibly important. Any of you that have dared to open the hood of your cars made any time in the last 10 or 12 years know that it is not as simple as it used to be, and we are constantly looking for students who are gifted in both math and computers and technology to work on cars in the shops, because most cars have a greater computing capacity now than the original moonshots had when they left the 1960s. There are multiple computers running cars, and the way they interface with one another and the complexity of replacing a part on a vehicle with a new part or maybe a used part, and making sure the computers are talking to one another through different systems is increasingly complex. And so it's important that we have programs both in high school and at the community college level that are taking these students who are not only gifted in again, applied mathematics and computers, but also who have an interest in cars and enjoy this stuff, and to find those kids and to provide meaningful programs for them. So we appreciate your support for these programs.
Thank you, Darrell.
Yes, Rip Gorsuch.
To the gentleman from, well, the Aggie. Sorry, I couldn't remember. With all of the renewed interest that we're seeing for urban farming, is there any resurgence in terms of kids in cities being more interested in farming?
Chair Denbrough, Representative Gorsuch, you know, I'm not entirely sure. I can look into that and get back to you, but I think you do see some more interest in the urban areas, getting farming more at a higher level, awareness level, and that's definitely something, you know, we support, and it's something we'd like to encourage.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Yes. We have one last panel, so I would like to call up Laura Roach and Larry Shane and Travis Ryman. You're going to start us off, Laura?
I will. This is, I want to get this top. I want to show you that.
While she's getting set up, Laura is the Czarina of CTE in the Department of Ed, and worked closely for a number of years now on these efforts, and thank you.
Good morning, Chair Denbrough and members of the committee. I'm Laura Roach. I'm the director in the Department of Education for the secondary, post-secondary transitions team, and my team also provides leadership for career and technical education. Much of what we would share with you has been shared with you already this morning, so I'm going to flip through these little PowerPoints real quickly. And Larry, I believe I failed to pass those out, so if you would ask. Basically, I'd like for you to understand that across the state, we have about 600 high school programs and approximately a few over 600 community college programs. And our goal over the last 6 years has been to align those programs so students that are coming out of high school would have a next step opportunity, particularly with community colleges. We have six career areas that we work with. We have health, we have industrial and engineering, business and management, arts, education, and agriculture. So across the state, these groups are organized in a way that we can talk about them, but really they break down to about 123 pathways. I wanted to thank you for investing in your students here in Oregon and giving them an opportunity to try to have career and technical education revitalized. We believe we have lost about 30% of our programs over the last few years due to funding cuts, to teacher preparation programs, those kinds of things. And when the CTE revitalization grant was awarded, it was awarded in a way that the funding would go to secondary programs, and then they were responsible for finding their post-secondary partners, whether it be a community college or a business partner or whomever. And funds were able to flow to the community colleges for the services they provided. Many of you know that we live on federal funds a lot of times in the Department of Education, and at the high school level, we have gotten just around $13 million for biennium, and the community colleges get about that much, too, from Perkins federal funds. So when the money comes in during the year, we divide it in half, 50% for community colleges and 50% for secondary programs, and then the Department of Education does the fiscal, some of the fiscal management for that. As you can see here, the revitalization funds in the green brought us back to just slightly above a level of 2007 and 9. As funds have been decreased federally, we have felt that impact, and therefore the schools have felt that impact too. So we're hoping that through this grant that we can continue to incent high schools and community colleges to develop the programs we need in the state. You heard about grant purpose, and it was collaboration, and a program of study is something that's really organized and planned so a student can get the training they need in the comprehensive high school. It's composed of content standards, industry standards, alignment and articulation. They have technical skill assessments as well as academic assessments, and they have student support services. I think you can see here that the facts on what happened with the grant process, and that was referred to earlier. I just wanted you to take a quick glance at where the awards went last year. We tried to provide them across the state, big schools, small schools. We had a lot of applicants who could have had a really top quality program, but we made an effort to make sure that a little bit of the money went somewhere across the state. You've heard about the grant recipients, but I wanted to point out the community college partners that they're working with. As you can see, each one of them had a community college partner, and they provide services together. Again, here are some of the grant recipients: Treasure Valley, Shenandoah, Wingdon. All of those colleges were involved in the process. Part of the conversation today, I guess, is about establishing a statewide CTE advisory committee. And I wanted to share with you the fact that between the Department of Community Colleges and ODE, there are a number of committees that have input into statewide CTE programs. We have a CTE network that is composed of high school secondary teachers. It has CTE regional coordinators and community college leaders, and they meet four times a year. They also have a communications team, and we go to them for input on policy, how we're going to spend our leadership funds, and ask them to help us communicate across the state. We have just convened a CTE Career Pathways statewide committee. Oregon was one of five states that was selected by the Office of Vocational Adult Education to consider how we could put together our CTE programs of study and the career pathways work that's being done at community colleges to create a system of career pathway information and opportunities for students. Up until this time, because they're such large initiatives, they worked a little bit separately, and so we received not money, but technical assistance to help us move the system forward. We have the proposed CTE Revitalization Grant Committee, the CTE Interagency Committee between BOLI, ODE, and CCWD. We're also involved in the Partnerships for Occupational and Career Information, which includes CCWD, ODE, the Career Information System, and I'm trying to think who I'm missing, I think, and Oregon Employment Department. We also have six advisory boards associated with student and career organizations, and we have staff assigned to each one of those six organizations. We will be looking perhaps at a STEM Investment Council, and we've always worked with the Workforce Investment Board. So these are some of the statewide committees that are already in place, and so the challenge for us is to bring these together in a meaningful way and have each of these committees work toward a significant outcome. But we are not working in isolation, as it is sometimes perceived. We work very hard to include our workforce partners wherever possible, and then to include them in the decision-making as well. So, Representative Demereau, if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Why don't we hear from the rest of the panel first? Okay. Larry, so tell us the community college perspective.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. I'm Larry Shane with the Oregon Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And obviously this morning you've heard a lot about the integration and connection between education, workforce preparedness, the policy boards that are involved, and those types of entities. And Laura did a great job of the essential overview of advisory committees. I thought I might just touch briefly on the State Board of Education's role in that. Laura mentioned there's about 600 or so programs at Oregon's community colleges that are in career and technical education. Those right now result in about 1,000 certificates or degrees that are approved by the State Board of Education. So, you know, you have the 600 programs, you have various certificates and degrees that exist within those programs. In order for them to be approved by the State Board of Education, there's a number of standards that they have to meet. And I'm just going to draw out three of those standards that are particularly relevant when it comes to advisory committees. One is need. So we've talked about that quite a bit this morning already. The advisory committee is part of that process and basically helps to establish that there is a local need for that program in terms of the workforce. Another standard is collaboration. The advisory committee often ensures that that program is connected with appropriate labor and industry, other education providers, workforce services and boards, and community-based organizations. And then the last standard that I'd talk about is alignment. And that's where I think the advisory committee really and the members of advisory committees really enjoy what they're doing and really get into it, because that's where you're talking about it, the program aligning with certifications, licensure, what should the curriculum look like, what should be the outcomes for the student, what's the relevant technology that should be used in that program. So that's really the nuts and bolts of it. Program approval requires that each award is annually updated. So there's an initial approval through the State Board of Education, and then at a minimum, they are renewed at least annually, oftentimes more often than that, because of the role of the advisory committee and changes in outcomes that are needed or changes in technology that needs to be used. And the final thing I'd say is that colleges and or the programs often have in place bylaws or a fairly sufficient and relevant structure for those advisory committees. I've seen a number of those where they have the handbooks in place. It talks about the roles for the advisory committee. You know, just the standard things that you would see that a committee would have. You know, terms of service, how often do they meet, those types of things. And the final thing that I'd mention is with the career pathway certificates of completion, and you've heard about those a little bit this morning too. Those are, it's amazing to me the number of people that are involved in those, because those are so specific to one occupation. You really get quite a wide breadth of individuals that come, even though it's very specific to one occupation. I've seen career pathway certificates that may have 15 or 20 advisory committee members, just because of the interest in that structure in Oregon right now.
Thank you, Larry. We heard earlier the great success rate for students in CTE programs of study at the K-12 level. But in my experience, the students in CTE programs at the community college level are also much more successful, you know, in terms of their completion rates than the mainstream population. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yes, Chair Denbrough.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Travis, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Denbrough and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me share. My name is Travis Ryman. I'm the Executive Director for Teaching and Learning and Bilingual Programs in the Hillsborough School District. And I hope to be able to serve the committee this morning by sharing some K-12 perspective. I'm here with Kim Strelchin, a school board member from Hillsborough, and we're proud of our CTE efforts, our STEM programs, and our College and Career Pathways project, and we'd like to add our voices to the groups of folks today who would like to see these bills funded. And I'd particularly like to comment on the importance of the joint advisory committees recommended by the House Bill 2912. Last Thursday evening, I attended a sold-out awards banquet called the Crystal Apple in Hillsborough. The Crystal Apple Awards are put on by our local Chamber of Commerce. And among recipients of Crystal Apple Awards were a veterinary doctor, a Hollywood makeup artist, and others who had demonstrated exemplary partnership with our schools in terms of setting up internships for our students in our CTE programs. We also had Don Domes, who's known locally as a guru of CTE programs from Hillsborough High School. Mr. Domes was given a Crystal Apple Award as well. Dr. Rudy Crew was there at the banquet as a keynote speaker, and he got a laugh out of the audience when he said he hadn't really come to be inspired. He was there to provide inspiration, but what he saw in the banquet was all the innovation in Hillsborough around connecting kids in school with meaningful career and college pathway opportunities. We in Hillsborough think that the governor's goal of 40-40-20 is an achievable goal, and it's also consistent with our values as an education system. We also think that it's critical, the kind of partnership that is recommended by House Bill 2912 is critical to making 40-40-20 happen in our state. We educate kids because we know that the same skills that are required to have a family wage job right out of high school are the same skills that kids need to be successful in college. We believe that all kids in grades K through 12 should be able to go to college, but we also notice that students in our programs are looking for employment right out of high school. They're members of that first 20. We also have students who are ready to enter career and technical education programs and apprenticeships, which would make them part of that first 40. And then we have a group of kids who are ready to go to four-year institutions and are ready to be part of that third 40 group, if that makes sense. The problem in our district, and I think statewide, is helping kids and families be crystal clear on what it means to be part of that 20 or that 40 or that 40, and creating clear pathways to career training and advanced education opportunities out of high school. When a student comes into a counselor in our district and says that he likes working with cars, that counselor needs to be able to have a conversation with that student about what it looks like to graduate from high school and get a job at one of our local companies changing oil. Also, what it would look like to achieve a certain amount of certification as a mechanic and be able to identify what those job opportunities are and what that would mean in terms of earnings over a lifetime. That student also might be interested in exploring an advanced degree in designing and building automobiles. So whether you're a member of the 20, the 40, or the 40, students need to know that that pathway, where it begins and where it ends, and what the branches of that tree are. We believe that a partnership between labor, industry, higher ed, public schools, families, and students is critical to achieving the 40-40-20 goal of the governor, and also to helping students find family wage jobs in Oregon. As a representative of the Hillsborough School District, we look forward to that partnership and serving on that advisory committee when this bill passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryman. Colleagues, any questions of these gentlemen? Yes, Rep. Huffman.
Do you know what the Hillsborough's graduation rate is, four-year?
I think our four-year graduation rate is 80-plus percent in Hillsborough. We have one of the higher graduation rates in the state. I'd have to get back to you with specific stats.
I was thinking 82 or something like that. So
that's great.
Thank Kim's you. Nodding her head, too. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yes, Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, we don't get the names up here, and I didn't catch your names.
Today. Travis Ryman. Thank you.
Travis, I've been sitting here for almost 2 hours, and I have didn't realize it. I have been waiting for you all morning.
Thank you, Representative.
And you could be in trouble now.
You know, if I hear one more PowerPoint on organizational stuff, I may have to go out of here. I'm one of the more challenged representatives up here. So would you just say a little more about one of those Crystal Apple Award winners? Because I'm in the mood for a quick story, if you've got one.
Yeah, well, would you like to hear one that's on the... you know, I was really intrigued by the vet who got one. She's a doctor. And I think when we think about... how to be a doctor and how to go to a university. I was impressed by the story that students in Hillsborough actually pursuing veterinary medicine as a career. I was intrigued by that because I heard somebody mention earlier Future Farmers of America and FFA. I think sometimes in terms of our college and career pathways, we look at health sciences as the career pathway for a future doctor. But why wouldn't that be agriculture, food, and natural resources as a career pathway? And why wouldn't our FFA program show a student what it would be like to raise animals on one level, but then pursue advanced degrees in medicine to serve in our agricultural businesses, that same pathway, different level of educational commitment. You know, the other one that I saw was Don Domes. I'll talk about him a little bit. His programs straddle different career pathways as well. He's got students in IT, looking at IT businesses, but he also is building things with AutoCAD and looking at construction engineering jobs. So I was inspired by the sort of breadth of interest and representation from different industries at that event, all the way from folks on the right brain side to the left brain side, from arts and communications to engineering. And what we're realizing is that there are post-high school opportunities for students in any of those career areas, and there are advanced degree opportunities as well. It's just unclear for a lot of families how to jump from high school into the next thing, especially if it's not a four-year degree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would say, with respect,
yes. You
could tell similar stories, as could, we're missing him right now,
Yeah. Other
advocates at the community college level. So thank you. That was very helpful to me and refreshing. I'm back in the game.
Thank you, Gillian.
Just in time.
Yes. This is the beginning of a long week for us, so that is important for you to leave here happy. Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Travis, I too, like Rep. Gillian, thrilled to see someone from the K-12 world here, because we haven't heard from you all yet as we've seen all the spaghetti straps about alignment and all this stuff, but I'm going to ask you some real practical questions. Do you know how many staff positions Hillsborough has eliminated over the past, let's say, 4 years, approximately?
Wow. You know what? I don't. We've been.
Your board member behind you could answer that. But
what's interesting about our districts, our class size has gone from, I want to say, 29-1 to 32-33-1 over the last few years. We have been real strategic in our investments and have not been, we've not activated a reduction in force wholesale across our district. We have eliminated programs. We have raised class size across the board. It's not uncommon to see an elementary school or a middle school class with 35 or 40 students in it.
Thanks. I ask that as another school board member to you all. I understand what you're going through, and that's the thing that doesn't get addressed often enough in all of this organizational stuff, is just the reality of what exists at the school district level. Mm-hmm. That many of these programs that have been eliminated over the past years haven't been eliminated electively. They've been eliminated as a life-saving measure to try to keep class sizes at 35. And that doesn't get emphasized enough. And, you know, my personal feeling would be that until this legislature gets serious about addressing the cost drivers at the local level, we're going to have a very hard time expanding any sort of educational offerings, whether it's CTE or additional STEM, you know, focus or whatever. It's going to be very, very hard for you all to do what we hope you would do. So,
you know, Chair Denbrough and Representative Johnson, if I may, I think critical in the conversation is a partnership between community colleges, and labor and industry, because the kind of joint advisory committee that this bill recommends would allow us to talk about how we start to get our high school students engaged in community college credits, basically opening university early to high school students. I think there's a mutual benefit to higher ed and K-12 ed to make those connections happen for kids, and it would be a cost savings overall.
Perfect.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I have one question for you, if I might. In reviewing Section 2, which addresses that committee that's a repair report, I wonder, in addition to the factors that are identified there as those that would be researched by the board or by the committee, if we could also look at identifying some of the systemic barriers, i.e. deterrence to some of this collaboration. I'm talking about perhaps some, if the department's represented, ODE, are there curriculum impediments that are making it more difficult for some of these CTE courses to be offered and so forth? Are there funding formula issues that are also impediments to greater dual accreditation and so forth as well? But to have a more of a, let's look at it from the academic portion too. Are there mandates that the department still insists on at the local level that are preventing folks like Travis and his folks in Hillsborough from offering more CTE type courses. Just a thought.
Yeah.
If you look at the big rocks, if you will, that we came out of our other interim committee with.
No, I think that makes sense, Rep. Johnson. I don't know that we need to actually put it in the statute, but I don't think it would hurt. That is, I think, that was the intention for these quarterly meetings that are happening between BOLI and CCWD and ODE to look at that kind of thing, you know, how to remove some of these barriers that are in place, as well as incentivizing partnerships.
Chair Bimbro, we might respond by saying part of the Career Pathways Steering Committee work that we just put together would address how, you know, some of the barriers and identify those so that we could pass those forward to those who have the capacity to influence the decision-making. So that would be part of our Pathways work group between ODE and CCWD and our key partners.
But In follow-up to your request, I would be happy to have an amendment drafted that would call that out more specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great.
Rep. Gallegos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Johnson for really acknowledging the issue of school funding. I mean, I think that I also want people to know that this is my district that we're talking about. And I think that also to recognize that I think District 30, Hillsborough, provides a sort of a very special laboratory for the very issues we're talking about this morning in terms of workforce development, working with local school districts and so on. What, 2 weeks ago, the governor was at Oracle and really was a result of a lot of partnership spearheaded by the Chamber of Commerce that held the function last week. But I do want to, despite and really thank you for the presentation, and you made us proud. So, but I also recognize then the whole issue of school funding and how critical it really is, despite these great achievements. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Rep. Gallegos. So, colleagues, in about an hour, we'll be learning what's in the co-chair's budget, and we will perhaps have a better sense of what our struggle is going to be, you know, in terms of fighting for some of these programs that we heard about today. But I think, you know, this is something that I know everyone on this dais is committed to. So thank you, panel. Joe, did you want to say something?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll call you up just briefly. Thank you very much, all of you. Oh, and as Joe is preparing to speak, Cassie is passing around the Senate version bill, and there you can see everyone's name on it. You can see virtually every legislator is there, and if they're not there, it's your job to go beat them up. Okay.
Yes, he is.
Okay, yeah, Joe.
On that note, for the record, my name is Joe Esmond. I'm a business agent with the IBW Local 48. A couple things, if I can add.
Please.
Every day, 10,000 people are retiring. There is a skilled workforce that I'm sure could be tapped. Second thing, at one time I worked for a large high-tech firm in Hillsborough, and they would throw stuff away. And I would get permission and take that to our school so our students could learn, you know, with the hands-on. Third thing, I know there's a school district in the metropolitan area that has rooms full of equipment that's just sitting there. I'm going to guess there are other school districts in the same way in the state. So instead of spending money for new stuff, I'm sure when you're starting out that you could use some older stuff existing. And the fourth thing, just for Representative Gilliam, my sister did stagecraft in high school outside of Philadelphia, and for 40 years she's worked on Broadway as a wardrobe mistress, so outside of construction. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Joe.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Rep. Huffman.
I just want to thank Joe on the record for his unwavering support of CTE over the years and working with us on various bills.
Yes. Rep. Gilliam.
I want to thank Joe as well for talking to me specifically when he said in relationship to technology, old stuff and new stuff. That made sense to me.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Joe.
You're welcome.
Okay, colleagues, with that, I'm going to close this concurrent public hearing on House Bill 2110, 2912, and 2913, and we are adjourned.